Climate outcomes.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You are listening to an end-of-the-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Eliza Yurkov. The producer is Eliza Yurkov, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegedoff, Isabel Charlet, Brian Bull, Alex Gonzalez, Danielle Smith, and Suzanne Potter. Our evening news director is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All our KBOO programs are made possible by support from our members. KBOO is currently in our end-of-the-year fundraising drive, and our goal is to raise $75,000 by December 31st. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
From the Coast Range Association, this is Coast Range Radio. I'm Michael Gaskill. We've explored fire policy and politics more than almost any other topic on this show, and for good reason. Like it or not, fire politics affects every aspect of public forest policy and the rural landscape, and that is not changing anytime soon. But is science or politics guiding the policy? Are management decisions being made with forest ecology and community resilience as the top priorities? Or are certain actors using fire as a smokescreen to score political wins, enrich wealthy mill owners, and prop up an outdated ideology that wants to turn public forests into tree plantations? More relevant to today's conversation, what is the best available science actually telling us about fire and forest health? About how, if, when, and why to take an active role in shaping forest landscapes with fire, healthy forest ecology, and fire-resilient communities in mind. I'm joined today by Dr. Kimberly Davis from the Forest Service's Missoula Fire Sciences Lab and Dr. Carrie Metlin, Senior Forest Scientist for the Nature Conservancy in Oregon. They are two of the lead co-authors of a meta-analysis published this year examining the effects of thinning, prescribed fire, and wildfire on subsequent wildfire severity in dry-type conifer forests of the western U.S. They're an absolute wealth of knowledge, and I was so appreciative of their ability to get into the complexities of their research in a way that was both engaging and very understandable. And side note, if you don't know, a meta-analysis is a type of study that takes a whole bunch of different studies and research papers on a subject and analyzes them together to determine larger trends and conclusions. So before we get into the conversation, a few quick notes. First, I want to caveat that this paper and the interview were focused on dry and semi-dry forest types, which have very different fire regimes than the wetter forests of the Coast Range and west slopes of the Cascades. But I think this conversation offers valuable insight into how research is conducted and some of the dynamics at play in public land management decisions. Second, this interview was recorded before the election, which feels important to note for some reason. And I also want to underscore that this conversation is primarily about the research and science of fire ecology and treatments, not the policy and politics around it. Though I do try to touch on some of those questions later in the interview. You can check out our archives and stay tuned for future episodes focusing more on the politics around fire and forests, which is likely to be a major battleground in the next administration. And I know I say this all the time, but I really had to cut out so much good stuff for this radio version of the show. If you want to hear the full conversation, you can find Coast Range Radio on any podcast app like Spotify, Apple Podcasts, etc., or click the Coast Range Radio tab at the top of our website, coastrange.org. I've included extensive links in the podcast show notes and on the website, including links to the study itself and other resources, as well as links to previous episodes we've done on fire. And as always, my email is michael@coastrange.org. Please reach out anytime to let me know what you think of the show and what topics you'd like to hear covered. Okay, let's get to my interview with Dr. Kimberly Davis and Dr. Carrie Metlin. I started by asking Kim to summarize the key findings of the report.
Well, overall, we found that these treatments that we studied were overwhelmingly effective for reducing fire severity of subsequent fires. And so in particular, treatments that reduced tree density and also returned low intensity fire to our forests really reduced the subsequent fire severity by, you know, over 60%. And so treatments were very effective. The most effective treatment was thinning with prescribed burning, and that reduced fire severity of a subsequent fire by 72% on average. So a really big impact on our forests.
Yeah, just to kind of set the stage here, from my understanding, what you all studied was a few different types of treatment strategies. You looked at thinning and then doing a prescribed burn afterwards. Thinning and then doing pile burns, which is kind of, you know, what folks in Oregon are familiar with as slash piles. Thinning only with no burn afterwards, prescribed burn only, and prior wildfire. So maybe you could just run down the numbers of each of those real quick, and then we could dig into that.
Sure. And maybe to just back up and talk about, you know, why these different treatment types exist or what level of fuels that they are affecting.
Yeah.
So, you know, historically, many of the forests that we studied burned frequently or moderately frequently in low intensity or mixed severity wildfires. And so due to both the suppression of indigenous burning, the suppression, active fire suppression, as well as logging of large trees, we've kind of lost this historical forest structure that we've had in a lot of these areas. And then we're combining that with climate change, which is making these areas more likely to burn because the fuels are really dry for a longer period of time. And so treatments to try to address this can affect what we call canopy fuels, or the fuels like in the crown of the trees. And so whether or not a fire can be what we call an active crown fire, where it kind of moves through the canopy from tree to tree, depends on how much fuel you have up in those canopies and how close together the trees are. Then we also have surface fuels, or the fuels on the ground, like sticks or shrubs or grasses or pine needles, litter, stuff on the ground is also an important fuel, and that affects how the fire spreads on the ground. And if you have a lot of that, that can lead to really high intensity surface fire or promote like what we call tree torching, when a tree just goes up in flames, or even help transition to a crown fire. And so these treatments try to either reduce the canopy fuels, like through thinning, so that's an important part of the process, or also treat the surface fuels through prescribed burning, or taking a lot of those surface fuels and putting them in a pile and burning them. That's, yeah, how these treatments are designed. That's why the most effective treatment was thinning with prescribed burning, because it's treating both fuel types, and that reduced fire severity by 72% on average. The next most effective treatments were prescribed fire only, or thinning with pile burning, which both reduced fire severity by 62%. And I would just note that we can't necessarily go in and do prescribed fire everywhere. There's many places where it's too dense. There's too much fuel to just go and burn safely. And so these areas that where they were able to do only prescribed fire without thinning maybe had lower densities to begin with. And then finally, the thinning only, that reduced fire severity by 28%. That treatment was not quite as effective because it did leave, you know, surface fuels. And then also prior wildfire reduced fire severity by 25%. And I'm happy to go into more details about wildfire and its the potential use here in a little bit.
Yeah. I think because you did touch on the importance of letting natural fire burn when conditions allow and when able, you know, obviously letting nature do the work for free. We're going to talk about kind of cost effectiveness a little bit at least today, because the pot of money is not unlimited here. I think it's fascinating that prescribed burning is as effective as thinning and pile burning, and also that it is not as effective as thinning and prescribed burning, but pretty dang effective, with the caveat, of course, that it is site-specific.
Yeah, I mean, I think I already touched on it, but Carrie probably has some more thoughts on it. But basically, you can't just go in and burn anywhere. We've crossed, you know, the point of being able to do that in many of our forests. And so in some places, tree density is a lot higher, but we also have trees that are growing really fast, like in productive forests, like you have in Oregon, where then if you go in with a prescribed fire only, those trees have grown to the point where they're fire resistant and they won't be killed by the prescribed fire alone. And so you won't necessarily get a reduction in tree density like you might if you're burning in a place that just has smaller trees.
Right. Carrie, did you want to jump in?
Well, sure. You know, and so I've got a fair amount of experience working with collaborative forest groups down here in southwestern Oregon, down in the Rogue Basin. You know, we like to get out there and do underburning as an initial entry when we can, but the honest truth is that that's a very limited occurrence. Instead, what we find is as we look across a landscape, there's variable conditions and we need all of the tools in the toolbox in order to address that landscape meaningfully. And so we actually did an assessment in southwestern Oregon called the Rogue Basin Strategy. We published it in 2021 and we used various data sets to understand the existing condition of the forest and then what we thought maybe needed to happen. And we were looking for where we would do ecological thinning, where we would do prescribed fire. And it's worth noting that the outcome of that analysis suggested that only on 20% of the area that we would have treated, we could have done underburn only. And that just wouldn't get us to treating enough of the landscape to meaningfully address forest health, to meaningfully address wildfire risk to communities, to meaningfully address wildfire risk to spotted owl. What we saw from that analysis is we really needed all the tools in the toolbox.
I totally hear that. And I think that one of the important things from a conservationist perspective of this paper is the importance of the burns to wildfire treatments. Because I think a lot of what you hear from the timber industry is just the thinning part, right? And frankly, in the Coast Range, you just hear straight up, well, clear cuts are the way to stop forest fires, which is not something that is in the scope of our conversation. But I only editorialize on my soapbox there to just say like how important you are all are demonstrating the burning aspect, whether it's prior wildfire, whether it's prescribed burn, whether it's a pile burn, et cetera, how important that is as a tool.
Well, and there's no doubt about that, Michael. Fire is an absolutely critical process for these forests. So for millennia, these vegetation types evolved with fire. And for millennia, people interacted with these landscapes and used fire to manage for the things they valued. And we have really good evidence that beginning in the mid-1800s with colonialization by Euro-Americans, that tool was taken away from the indigenous tribes. And we started to manage, for high severity fire regimes. So low severity fire regimes are those where fires come somewhat frequently when fuels are available to burn under an array of different fuel moistures and an array of different weathers. With fire suppression, we've sort of narrowed the window of when fires can happen. And what that effectively does is create a situation where you have fire exclusion, forests grow very dense, you get a lot of fuel, and then you only get fires when it's hot and dry because you can't control it anymore. And so our management for high severity fire has had predictable consequences. And my hope is that, you know, this paper helps us think through how we can, again, use the tools in the toolbox, ecological thinning and underburning together in order to set these forests up on a more sustainable trajectory.
I think that framing that in effect we've managed for high severity fires is really important. It underscores the fact that we are active in what has happened there. And I do want to get into some of the thorny questions around incentives around thinning a little later in the discussion. But first, because this is an important piece as well that you touched on, time scale of treatment effectiveness. I mean, that's a big deal. Could you touch on that a little bit?
Sure. Yes. So we did our best to extract from every study that we looked at, you know, how old the treatments were when the fires went through and burned them. And some papers provided more precise data, like the exact age, and some said, you know, older than 10 years or younger than 10 years. What we ended up doing was grouping our treatment age category into younger than 10 years or older than 10 years, because we just didn't have enough detailed data. But what we found was that treatments that were younger than 10 years, younger or equal to 10 years when they burned, were much more effective than treatments that were older than 10 years old when they burned on average. So on average, across all the different treatments and forest types, these treatments that were 10 years or younger when they burned reduced fire severity by 66%, whereas the treatments that were older than 10 years reduced it, but only by 28%. And so there is a big difference. That said, the thinning and prescribed burning combined was the most effective for the longest time period. So if we look at just the thinning and prescribed burning treatment, those treatments that were older than 10 years, we predicted there'd be an average 49% reduction on average in those areas. So those treatments will last the longest. And that's because when you use the prescribed fire after the thinning, you're killing some of the younger regeneration that would grow up and become a ladder fuel if you didn't do some sort of prescribed burning treatment in the understory. So basically there does need to be like a plan to come back and retreat areas, and exactly how frequently that is will depend on the productivity of the site, you know, historically how frequently it burned, but on average, probably around every 10 to 20 years in our drier forest types. And what we hope is that the second entry, the second time you come back, you won't necessarily need to thin. You'll just be able to go in and burn, and hopefully it'll be maybe lower cost and easier to get that treatment done.
Right. When you're dealing with deferred maintenance, when I haven't weeded my garden for a long time, it's a lot harder than when I'm out there, you know, every week, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And we have some colleagues in the Southeast who've, done multiple burn entries. The first and the second entry are usually pretty challenging. And by the time you get to a third and a fourth entry, where you're sort of tiered to that historical fire regime that would have maintained a healthy forest, you start to have, a system that sort of works better with fire, and those costs do come way down.
Yeah, right. So that's, important to note when we're talking about, how much this is all going to cost and stuff. We're talking about kind of a pulse of needed activity here. So Kim, you wanted to go back at some point to the importance of letting natural fires burn. And I also wanted to touch on that as well. So since your review finds that prior wildfire is not particularly effective compared to other treatments at preventing high severity fires, what is the importance of letting natural fire burn when possible?
First of all, we can't physically go in and treat all the landscapes that have been affected by fire suppression. We don't have the time, the money, or the capacity, or even the ability. You know, some places are just too steep. They're too far away from roads. It's just too remote. And so allowing or managing natural ignitions, managing wildfire, is a really important component because it can treat large areas that we can't treat. You know, our prescribed burn units are relatively small compared to the size of a wildfire. The other thing is that when we use managed wildfire, they tend to burn at lower severity than wildfires that we're actively suppressing because they're burning during periods when the fire weather conditions are less extreme. And so we're more likely to get these low or moderate or mixed severity effects than these fires that are burning, you know, when it's really hot and dry. And one of the key points from our findings was that we did have the overall effect size was about 25% reduction in subsequent fire severity when you had an initial wildfire, but that was including all different types of initial wildfire. And so when you dive down into like what was the first wildfire like in terms of severity, those areas that burned at low or moderate severity in the first fire were much more effective at moderating the effect of the subsequent wildfire. This study and then other studies that I've been involved with and other studies by many researchers across the West have shown that, you know, low or moderate severity wildfires can play a really important role in reducing the fire severity of the next fire. They can be effective, and particularly when they're not burning at high severity that first time around.
That's such a great point. I'm glad that you're, bringing in that deeper context and digging below the initial numbers there. So trust and credibility really matters here. I work for a conservation organization, a lifelong lover of forests, and I don't think it's controversial to say that the Forest Service mismanaged millions of acres through, you know, especially starting post-World War II, right up until, I would say, the Clinton administration and the end of the timber wars. My concern is that, and I think this is echoed within the conservation community, my concern is whether the Forest Service has done enough to re-earn the public's trust around these credibility questions. I work really hard to have an open mind on questions and acknowledge that I don't have all the answers. The answers I think I know are often wrong. And so when I see, let's say, some in the conservation community saying, like, the answer is never do thinning projects, just let natural fires burn, prescribed burn is fine, but just the answer is just let nature take its course. And then you have the Forest Service not saying the polar opposite, right? But having a different take. You have the timber industry saying, oh, we're the ones that are environmental stewards. All you have to do is clear cut, right? So the question is, what can the Forest Service do to demonstrate the kind of credibility, transparency, humility here to instill trust that the agency is acting competently and in good faith here? And Kim, if this is not something that you are able to speak to, no problem. But if you are, that's great.
Well, I'm not a social scientist. I don't know how people would get trust back. But I can say that from what I've seen within the Forest Service, people are working hard to try to use the best available science to make treatments more effective and do them where they're needed most. And I can speak to this idea that, oh, just let nature do its course. Like that is not even an option on the table, because we have caused climate change, and climate change has changed our world. And we've also had active fire suppression for over 100 years, and we've removed all the indigenous populations who manage the land for millennia. And so we are actively having an impact on all of our forests, whether it's like through going in there and removing trees or by suppressing that fire that's not going in there. So our conditions are not what they were, you know, 200 years ago, and our climate's not what it was 200 years ago. And so this idea that we can just do everything hands off and expect things to be okay is not grounded in like the scientific reality of what our ecosystems are like now and what we can expect with climate change.
Yeah. I mean, I personally agree with the fact that that ship has sailed. But again, that just underscores the importance of transparency and credibility, right? If we're saying, okay, we do have to act well. And again, this is getting off of a little bit of off course of what we're talking about today, but I think it's interrelated because fire connects so much policy in forest management. It just overlays everything, right? And I will just say, I think that humility is the thing that I personally see lacking. And again, I apologize for getting on my soapbox, but where I see the Forest Service caused massive harm to ecosystems and communities through the liquidation era. And then I just don't feel like that's been repaired, right? So we see them now, after then saying, well, we know what's best for forests and you tree huggers don't. Now it's basically the same attitude with better science, but it still, I think for a lot in the conservation community, still feels like the same attitude.
I mean, one thing that I would say is we're in a very different context than before the Northwest Forest Plan. Right? Incentives, partners, even, you know, the incentive structure for the organizations, it's different.
Yeah.
Right? Than it was before the Northwest Forest Plan. And I would say that, for example, for the BLM, you know, under their resource management plan, they are managing to keep the big trees, even on the timber base. They have diameter limits and they have age limits. And so I just went out on a field trip just last Friday, and it's these stands are treating in the timber base, but under the resource management plan, they were keeping trees over 35 inches and older than, you know, born after 1850, as well as, you know, a relatively high level of basal area. They're keeping, you know, trees on that landscape, and it looked really good. And how do you keep big old trees on a landscape? You manage for them, right? So I would invite you maybe to come down to the Ashland Forest Resiliency Project, where we treated 1,200 acres commercially, a lot more than that. Once you add in the non-merchantable and the underburning, it's a late successional reserve. There's certainly old growth forest there. But that old growth forest grew up with frequent fire. I've got data, fire history data, that shows that fires are coming back every 8 to 12 years. And then I think it's actually really cool. There is an agreement between the U.S. government and the city of Ashland in the 1890s to manage that watershed for the water value and to really limit the amount of timber harvest there. That's before the Forest Service.
Mm-hmm.
And then the city of Ashland engaged in the early 2000s to develop the Ashland Forest Resiliency work. And my point is, even these old growth forests have experienced fire exclusion. They are more dense. The big old trees are threatened because of our previous fire exclusion actions. And if we don't engage proactively in these forests that are overly dense, we'll lose the big old trees. And so it can be done. It can be done well. Again, I could take you and show you some places up in the Ashland watershed.
I would love to take you up on that.
Where we actually went in and we removed, it was 4,000 log truckloads drove through the city of Ashland, coming out of a late successional reserve. And the big old trees that stayed behind are looking pretty darn good.
I really appreciate you two having this conversation with me. You know, these tough conversations are really important. So thanks for that. And again, I'm going to take you up on that and get down to Ashland, Carrie.
Cool. It'd be fun. I can take you for a nice walk.
As we start to wrap up, I want to know, what are the biggest gaps in our knowledge in fire behavior right now? What do we really need to be researching that isn't well understood enough or isn't being researched or resourced enough?
You know, this paper, this review paper really did a good job of understanding what are the effects of treatments within that treated unit. But then there's the, I think, much bigger landscape question of what are the effects of multiple units within a landscape and what does that mean for that landscape?
Mm.
We, I think, have a lot of certainty that within a given treatment unit, prescribed fire combined with some thinning can really influence future wildfire. But we do need more research on the landscape effects beyond the unit boundaries. How do these treatments affect the process of fire?
Kim?
Yeah, that's a good point. What I'm really interested in, or that I think there's a lot of unknowns about, is, you know, as these fire regimes are changing because of climate change, so we're seeing more frequent or larger or in some places more severe fire, how our ecosystems will adapt. So a lot of my other research focuses on post-fire recovery and restoration, what options we have. And so thinking a lot about this like ecological transformation from a forest to maybe a non-forest and where that might be a risk. I typically work in pretty dry forests where we're starting to, you know, lose some of these forest cover transitions to grass and shrubland. And so thinking about what kind of options we have for helping our landscapes like move into this new era of warmer climate, more frequent fire, while maintaining resilience and some of the services that, you know, communities and other species depend on.
Well, is there anything we missed today, including, I forgot to ask you all up front, where folks should go to find your review or any other work that you all want folks to hear about?
Well, our review is published in Forest Ecology and Management, so you can find it there, and it's open access, so anybody can access it. There's no paywall. And then I would say links to other research that I've been working on can be found on my Rocky Mountain Research Station website profile. So
I guess I'm going to push you towards a story map that was produced by Susan Pritchard and some others. So there are these common questions that emerge when thinking about managing forests and fire. And I think Susan did a really nice job of thinking through what are those common questions and then digesting them into sort of reasonable bites.
Yeah, I will post all of these links in the show notes of our podcast feed and also on our Coast Range Radio show page at our website, coastrange.org. And we'll just have them all there for folks.
Great.
Well, you all were so generous with your time today, and I appreciate you letting me ask some tricky questions as well.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
All right, thank you all so much. Have a great day.
Thank you. Bye.
That's it for this episode of Coast Range Radio. Huge thanks to Dr. Kimberly Davis and Dr. Carrie Metlin for being so generous with their time. You can find this and all of our episodes on any podcast app and at the Coast Range Radio page of our website, coastrange.org. We have some great episodes coming up, and I would be grateful if you would help us out by sharing or recommending Coast Range Radio to a friend. Once again, my email is michael@coastrange.org. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back in a couple weeks.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
Don't know what to get your loved ones this season? Check out kboo.fm/merch to snag some KBOO swag to support community media in style. While you're shopping for gifts, you can make donations to help support KBOO